Hello and welcome to another episode of the County Cricket Podcast. I'm your host, Aaron, aka the Cricket Connoisseur, and on my left, as always, is my Lancastrian co-host, Joe Nutsy Nuttall. So, Joe, mate, how's your day been so far?
Pretty good, thanks. I've just been watching England this morning, which is quite good, doing toiling away in the field in Sri Lanka. It must have been a pretty long day, but yeah, good to see Jimmy picking up 3 wickets, so yeah, not bad.
Well, that's very, very good to hear, mate. And of course, with England, yeah, it was a rough day out in the field, I suppose. Mark Wood bowled his absolute heart out. And yeah, credit to him. But yeah, it looks like a bit of a road in goal at the moment, doesn't it?
Yeah, just a bit. So yeah, hopefully Johnny and Ruti can cash in on that.
And Sibley, of course. From a Warwickshire perspective. But no, mate, I'm glad to hear that you're doing well, of course, at these times. And also joining us on today's podcast is none other than former Middlesex wicketkeeper batsman, turned businessman slash author, David Nash. So, Nashy, first things first, mate, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast today. How's your day been so far?
Absolutely great, thank you. I don't want to rub it in, chaps, but I'm lucky enough to be in Barbados on a bit of work and a bit of pleasure. So it's the sun's out, the rum punches are flowing, and yeah, it could be worse.
Yeah, I mean, the envy is definitely flowing for us too at the moment. As I said earlier, it's 3 degrees here in Warwickshire at the moment. Joe, what's it like in Lancashire?
It is currently 6 degrees.
Oh,
not great.
That is gutting. But no,
keep
David.
Keep smiling, lads. It can only get better.
Exactly. Exactly. Very, yeah. Very true, David. But just for the listeners out there today, then, we're just going to be talking to David about his Middlesex career. We're also going to be touching upon the release of his brand new book, Bells and Boardrooms. And then we're going to end today's podcast with a cheeky bit of this or that. So, David, let's begin today's podcast then, right at the beginning of your cricketing journey then. What's your first ever memory of cricket, either playing or watching the game?
Oh, very, very good. My first probably memory of cricket would have been going to a Middlesex game when I was 6 with my dad at Uxbridge and watching the likes of my heroes, Desmond Haynes and Mike Gatting, play. And we always used to sit side on because I just couldn't believe how these guys had the talent to play the short pitch stuff that looked just like far too quick. And I just obviously loved the game. I wanted to be a cricketer, but I never thought that I'd be able to face that.
Well, yeah, two very, very talented batsmen there. Mike Gatting as well, of course, we'll touch upon in a bit. You got to play with him at Middlesex, didn't you?
Yeah, very, very lucky. Gat, one of my heroes, as I said. You know, you don't get a more talented player than him. And he was a brilliant cricketer, bowled a bit, caught pigeons at slip. He was a genius cricketer, that boy. And, I was very, very lucky and fortunate to share a changing room with him for, you know, 7 or 8 years whilst he was finishing up his career.
Definitely. And of course, there you mentioned two massive role models there. Were there any more inspirations or icons, per se, in the cricketing world that you really looked up to and almost wanted to emulate in your game?
That's a really, really interesting one. Obviously, as a youngster growing up, you know, the likes of both of them were the sort of legends. And I started off actually as a bowler. But there's no way who batted a bit. But I once took 6 wickets and 6 balls, which was my highlight. My old man was umpiring, Sunbury under 11s v Richmond under 11s. And he gave the first one out, LB, which he never did, which I couldn't believe. Second one was caught and bowled, and the last 4 were bowled. But I wouldn't say Richmond were much cop, to be honest. But yeah, it was a great day. I've still got the ball that got kindly mounted by the Richmond president, Hugh Goldie. So that was a nice touch from him.
Sounds like a brilliant memory. I mean, obviously, I can't relate with that. Joe, you ever taken anything close to 6 from 6?
Taking a hat trick, which was like under 9s. So I've actually still got the ball from that game as well. I don't know
Lovely.
How I ended up with it, but I do. So yeah,
nice memories.
Exactly. I mean, I don't really remember it personally, but I got a hat trick. Nobody can take that away from me, even if it was under 9s.
Exactly.
Yeah, it was that long ago now. It'd be cool to do something like that again, really. But yeah, who knows if that's ever going to happen. But let's move on now, David, to talk about county cricket and your experiences with county cricket. You've kind of already alluded to this a little bit. What were your first memories of county cricket?
Well, I was very, very lucky. Obviously, I signed a summer contract with Middlesex when I was 15 years old, when I was still actually at Malvern College. And I made my debut for Middlesex when I was 16. I remember Don Bennett picking me up. I'd played for Malvern College against Millfield Football on the Saturday, and it was the last Sunday league game of the season. Middlesex had nothing to play for, so they were like, oh, let's give the Shunster a game. So I remember full house at Taunton, the likes of Triscothic, Lathwell, Mushtaq Ahmed, etc., Caddick. Yeah, walking down the steps, like 6,000 people, full house with my heroes, Gatting, Haynes, Embry, Ramp Prakash, Tufnell, etc. And I remember feeling physically sick, going, Jesus Christ, you know, what am I doing here? But it was a great experience. I was very lucky, got a couple of catches, caught one off Fraser, caught one off Dean Nash, and got a stumping as well, off Tuffers, stumped Mark Lathwell, which was pretty cool. So I didn't get into bat, but it was that was a great memory. And, you know, it was the team that I'd supported from a young boy. I'd go to the games, get everyone's autographs with my dad. Mum would send us off with a packed lunch. So Lords as well, you know, what dreams are made of. Who wouldn't want to play for the team that, you know, you grow up and you played for since an under nine?
Well, you know there, David, you just mentioned, of course, batting alongside your heroes or sharing a field with your heroes on that occasion. Mm. Were you starstruck then? Were you, as soon as you walked into that dressing room, you're sharing a dressing room with the likes of Mike Gatting, who you mentioned was a real idol of yours. Did you almost feel very nervous and, as I said, very starstruck about sharing a dressing room with him?
Totally. Absolutely, totally. It was quite surreal, to be totally honest with you. You know, the legends of the game, and you just don't think that you're up to their skills and their abilities, which, to be honest, I wasn't. But and it proved to my career that I wasn't. But they were just absolute legends. They could, you know, do things that you dream of doing. And I used to watch him in the nets at Finchley, and we used to play on a lively surface at Finchley, indoor nets. It was like the old gym floor that would just skid on it. It was ridiculous. It was lethal. Particularly if they had new balls, and I'd watch him face the likes of Norman Cowans, Neil Williams in the nets, and without a helmet on, they'd just be pulling them in front of square, and I'd be like, oh my God, it was scary enough just to get underneath it and it thud into the back wall, let alone pull them in front of square with a floppy on in the indoor nets. Like, just ridiculous talent, the likes of him and Ramp Prakash, just another level.
100%. Yeah, I know we're going to keep on saying it, but they were fantastic batsmen. They really were. And then a couple of years later, David, of course, you made your first class debut. And this is a pretty famous debut, I suppose, for Middlesex in modern cricket, really. What do you remember from that day? What do you remember from that game at the Riverside in the 1997 County Championship?
All I sort of remember was Don Bennett, who was the guy that backed me at Middlesex, who was the coach for many years, absolutely brilliant. And he'd been backing me since an under 11, since he'd seen me throughout the age groups, and he'd always have time for me. Always, I think, you know, I'd been sort of earmarked as a player that could be one that would come through, because I was lucky enough to then play England under 15s, 17s and under 19s. So I was earmarked from sort of an under 11, really, where I started as an under 9 playing for the under 11s. So that day, you know, he was absolutely brilliant. He just sort of threw balls to me in the morning and just said, Nashi, look, you know, you're ready for this now. Just go out there and have some fun. Just watch the ball and back your ability. And, you know, if you need me for anything, I'm here for you. And I think I went out and got 90 odd, actually, on a wicket that was doing a little bit. I can't remember, 93 or 94 or something. And, you know, Simon Brown was, I think, swinging it round corners and had a few decent bowlers. And, yeah, I played all right. And, yeah, I was really, really happy. I think I played as a batter with Brownie still keeping Keith Brown, because, you know, dislodging Keith Brown, one of the toughest cricketers you'll ever faced, someone who averaged sort of high 30s with a bat, just a tough man and great cricketer. What wasn't easy, and he wasn't giving up the gauntlet easily, because he loved cricket and he didn't want to be eased out by a little scrote like myself.
Well, I'll tell you what, David, your memory has served you very, very well there. 94 on debut, that was spot on. And with regards to that, you were a specialist batsman, batting at six in a team with, as you mentioned, Keith Brown, Mike Gatting, O.S. Shah and Jack Callis, who, of course, are there just for the 1997 season. I mean, what a team that is.
Yeah, that's the problem with our Middlesex team then. We were good on paper, but how we didn't... Did we come... I think we might have come second that year. Did we
equal
come
fourth,
second runner-up?
Alongside Warwickshire.
Equal fourth, was it?
Yep.
Oh, right, equal fourth, blimey. But, you know, as I say, that team was... Did Johnson play as well?
believe
it was
so,
our bowling
yes.
attack. Yeah. We had a good team. You know, Gus Fraser as well, Johnson. Yeah. Tufnell, you know, Jesus Christ, that's a strong
Jamie
side.
Jamie Hewitt as well. Got 57 Huey. Wickets in that season.
Yeah, God, Huey is my good mate, Huey. Yeah, I remember that. All the boys, Gus and Jono, used to sort of joke that, Jesus, that, you know, they'd bowl, they'd keep it tight, bowl all the maidens, and Huey would just bowl half volley and they'd nick it or smash it to cover. I think by the end of the season, it was pissing them off a bit. But Huey could swing it, so he was a wicket taker. You know, if you can swing the ball, you got a chance. You look at the likes of what Tim Murta has done in their career. Absolutely unbelievable. Can swing it, just bowl good areas and know their game. And, you know, you get an amazing career like Tim Murta's. But going back to Jacques Callis, Jesus Christ, that bloke, what a talent. I mean, when he was in his early 20s there, you could see that the guy was going to just be an absolute world beater. He wasn't the most, shall we say, dedicated back then. You know, he liked a few beers and wasn't the biggest trainer. But I'm sure that, you know, that was when he was young. But the talent he had, he could bowl 90 mile an hour at will, swing it away. And just, you know, with the bat, he was just unbelievable. So just couldn't get the bloke out. So you knew that if he took a bit of work ethic with him, that you knew he would be one of the modern day greats. And he was.
Well, that's terrifying to hear that, because he still scored 1,034 runs. So as you said, imagine Jesus. If work ethic was up there. Jeez.
Oh. Yeah, he would. Yeah, all day long. That he was a young boy then, but what a cricketer he turned out in being. And to be honest, a standout guy, absolute top bloke, Jack. You know, you don't get a nicer guy. I think people give him a lot of abuse or whatever for being a bit dumb, but actually, he was actually quite a smart lad who's a really good chap.
And as you said, a quality all rounder, third leading Test run scorer of all time. And in your opinion, David, would you say he's the best all-rounder that you've ever seen on a cricket field?
Yeah. Yeah. No better than Jacques Callis. I've not seen anyone better than him. I really haven't.
I think there is many people who would agree with that.
I think Ben Stokes could probably, you know, could get up to that level, but I still think he's got a fair way to go.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. With regards to Callis, I mean, the guy is an absolute great of the game, not just modern great. That is a great of the game. As I said, third leading test run scorer of all time behind only Sachin Tendulkar and Ricky Ponting. And then you add onto that a shed load of wickets as well. I mean,
and a lot of slip catches.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. He was a multifaceted cricketer, wasn't he? As you said, a great slip fielder, fantastic at playing spin as well, great bowler, always used to take wickets at really opportune moments. I mean, what a player, Jacques Callis. Absolutely brilliant. But that's enough pining about Jacques Callis. Because I did just want to ask you, David, about another of your Middlesex teammates, and that is Sir Andrew Strauss. Because I've seen that you have quite a close relationship with Straussie. And I just wanted to ask, do you remember the first time that you actually met him? Do you remember the first time that you and Strauss actually crossed paths?
Yeah, actually, he played in a twos game. So I think he was going to Durham Uni, and he'd come back from Durham or whatever, and Gunnar Gould had... He'd basically heard that this guy was going to be decent from Andy Wagner from Radley College. And then he then pushed him forward when he went to Durham. And, you know, Wags was basically sort of like a friend of Middlesex, basically a bit of a scout and someone that pushes good youngsters through the club. And, met him in a twos game. I think we played at Southampton. Got on really, really well. He was a bit raw back then. He had his big curtains, his shocking red and blue jumpers that he always wore, his ill-fitting sort of polo Ralph Lauren jumpers and his boat shoes. He was a real posh boy, but, when he first came in the team, I certainly didn't think that he would be an England player in the making. I can assure you that. There was only one in our team, a youngster that I felt was going to be the England star, and that was Oeh Shah.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. Oeh, brilliant, brilliant cricketer. But yeah, with Straussie, that's funny to hear that, because, of course, went on to score 7,037 test runs.
100 tests later as well.
Exactly. And a brilliant captain.
Unbelievable. You don't get a better bloke than Andrew Strauss. You don't get a better leader than Andrew Strauss. He'd lead from the front. He'd be top of the fitness test. He'd never ask you to do something he wouldn't do himself. He had empathy for his players. He'd know when was the right time to put an arm around you. He'd know when was the right time to give you a kick up the arse. He's just a great, great person. And he worked harder than anyone else. You know, he used to employ his own fitness trainers in the winters to get himself fitter than everyone else. he wanted it more than anyone else. And let's be totally honest with you. If he's gone on to have an amazing career, he's an amazing human being. He's now a knight, which he thoroughly deserves. All the great work he's doing in memory of his late wife, Ruth, who was an amazing person on behalf of the foundation he set up, is truly inspirational. And yeah, you don't get a better guy. He's always been there for me. And, you know, I'm lucky to have a great mate.
Well, that's lovely to hear, David. And of course, as you said, I think a word that really does describe Andrew Strauss and encapsulates his morals really is an inspiration. Definitely. The fact when he led England, not only to glory in 2010-11, that magnificent Ashes series, but of course as well, also going on beyond that, taking England to the number one test team in the world. I mean, I do miss Andrew Strauss. And not only that, he was a good batsman as well, wasn't he? Very punchy, very gutsy batsman up the top
gutsy
of the...
Gutsy. Tough human being, Straussy. From a privileged background from the old private schools, you didn't get any tougher. I remember when we played Northants and Devon Malcolm was steaming in, hit him straight between the grill, split his face just open. It was just, his cheek was just hanging off. And I remember sort of just going in to see him in the physio's room and I was like, gee, I looked at it, I just felt ill. And I just said, you're right, mate. And he just said, yeah, fine. And he just said, you know, stitch it up. They stitched it up and he was back out there within 10 minutes. Just was unbelievable. Just I'd have been at hospital having a nice bit of ice cream with a couple of games off. And he was out there 10 minutes later, just a tough man. Tough man who wants to win, but does it in the right way.
Definitely.
Yeah. And that story really seems to encapsulate Andrew Strauss as a whole. As you say, he's so driven. And, you know, I mean, that opening partnership that he formed with Alistair Cook over the years at the top of the England order, it's similar to Broad and Anderson in a batting sense. You know, it really is. It's one of the modern great opening partnerships.
It was old school, wasn't it? A little bit like what they've sort of gone back to now with the openers. You know, you'd know they'd dry it up, they'd leave well, they'd have their areas in the fact that, you know, you couldn't bowl short to Cook, couldn't really bowl short to Strauss. But, you know, they'd have their fallibilities as well. You know, Mornay Morkel around the wicket to Strauss always struggled. Cookie sometimes when they went up there and bowled a bit fuller and straighter, maybe struggled, but they just found a way. You know, they would be the ones that it would be the bowlers that would crack first, not them. And God, they both had an amazing careers, didn't they? Let's be totally honest. They had amazing careers, but they're both unbelievably driven human beings, but they're both actually really, really top blokes. So it just shows you can be an amazing cricketer and a top bloke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it really does. And as I say, well, as you've pretty much summed up perfectly there, David, two absolute legends of the game. But let's bring the conversation back to your own career now and focus on your time at Middlesex as a whole. What would you say the proudest moment was in during your whole time at Middlesex? There's one thing that sticks out.
Proudest moment? Probably when I got 100 with Langer at Lord's as a youngster, because I was on a pair. Shah had just bagged a pair and he's walking through the long room and he just said to me, your turn now, and just gave me a bit of a wink. And I actually thought I was going to bag a pair. I was like, they had a great bowling attack. They had them all, Jarvis, Caddick, Rose, Mushtaq, you know, quality bowling attack. And I just thought, Jesus, there's no way I'm getting any runs here. You know, second innings, I'm probably getting a pair. And I went out and got 114 and put on 250 with Langer. He was like, Caddick was abusing me, to be totally honest with you. And Langer was then abusing him back. And it was just great fun. But it was a real proud moment because it just showed me that I could actually do it and I could actually stand up and, you know, face these great guys and do well. So that was a really proud moment for me. We didn't win anything really of note when I was there. We won a T20, but I wasn't really involved in it. We came second in the county championship one year, but runners up. But we won a few Division 2 titles, but that doesn't really count. But my career with Middlesex, we were more going through transition, so it was a bit disappointing. We didn't really deliver how we should have delivered for a big club, to be totally honest with you. But yeah, no, it was. I loved my time at Middlesex. Had 16 years there. Did all right. I don't think I ever let them down. You know, I did well for England under 19s, averaged 116 for England under 19s. Should have gone on, but unfortunately, I was racked with their self-doubt, anxiety, and towards the end, the last 5 or 6 years, if I'm totally honest with you, I didn't really enjoy playing the game. I wanted it to rain every day, as I feared failure hugely. And I was just doing it, just playing the game. So I didn't really want to let my parents down, and I had nothing else.
Well, we'll touch upon that in a bit, David, because, of course, that's going to be a real main focus of today's podcast. But just going back to that 1998 County Championship for just one moment, I did just want to ask about one player in particular, because I believe you got to play against him at Lords, and that is an absolute legend of my county of Warwickshire, Brian Charles Lara. And I believe in the game, it was a draw at Lords, scored 226 or 226 and out. What was it like keeping behind the stumps to an absolute legend of the game?
It was unbelievable. And I think I caught him once. I don't know. Obviously, it wasn't in that game if he got 226. But I remember Jono bowling, my best mate, Richard Johnson. And Jono had got him out quite a lot. And I remember a headline in one of the papers. I think he got him out 8 times in not that many innings. And I remember it, one of the headlines when Johnson was picked for England was, "Tricky Dicky makes Lara sicky." I thought that was a great, great headline from one of the tabloid papers. But mate, he was unbelievable. You know, you bowled anywhere near back of a length, it was off through mid-wicket, pulled hard. You gave him any width, it'd cut you to ribbons. And you get your length wrong and it'd drive you all day long. I mean, you just couldn't bowl to the bloke. He was just a genius, wasn't he? He was actually on another level. You know, if you actually sort of, even when you look at the likes of, you know, Callis and the players that we're talking about, Ponting, Brian Charles Lara, Jesus, I don't know too many people that can lace his boots.
Yeah, I'd completely agree with that. And I don't know if either of you boys saw this in 2020. I believe it's called the Bushfire Bash. It was held in Australia. I think it was held in St. Kilda. Yes. He was playing alongside Tendulkar, Wasim Akram, Ricky Ponting. And Brian Lara came out and he hit about 30 from 16 balls. And I was just thinking, imagine him in the modern game with T20. He'd still hold his own, wouldn't he? He was just a magnificently gifted cricketer.
Unbelievable. Just on another level.
Without doubt, yeah. Brilliant cricketer. And as I said, absolute legend of my county for a number of reasons. 501 out against Durham being one major one of those.
And, I mean, yeah, that's remarkable as well that he holds, obviously, that record
and the test
record as well.
It's remarkable. Against England, yeah.
And and whenever someone anywhere in the world gets past or gets remotely near 300, it feels like, oh, we could break Lara's record here. But I think that record could stand for, like, decades to come.
Definitely.
But it's just, you need many partners to bat with.
Obviously, when he got all those runs in Antigua, I think it was Antigua when he broke the record. And
it was, yeah.
Fraser and Tufnell were two of the bowlers, obviously good mates of mine. They were the bowlers that were out there for two and a half days or whatever it was, you know, toiling away. And they tell a story. Gus tells a story, which, you know, you don't get a better guy than Gus Fraser. He bleeds Middlesex through and through. He's just unbelievable. He loves the club. And he just tells a story that, you know, BC kindly invited him round for a barbie the next time they were on tour out there. And showed them the new house that he'd been built by, given by the government. And he's named the different parts of it after the bowlers that have effectively paid for it. So the Fraser wing and the Tufnell suite, et cetera, et cetera. It's absolutely hilarious.
That is outrageous. I mean, as I say, it's crazy that one man can score all those runs and, like, not even break a sweat, you know?
Just genius, just these gifted human being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Without a doubt. And the way in which he scored them as well, with so much swagger, so much flair, elegance, panache, pizzazz. I could keep on listing the word out, the thesaurus, but I'll leave it for the time being. Hopefully one day we'll get Brian on the podcast here on TCCP. But David, of course, I did mention there beforehand, just touching upon obviously the struggles that you had with Middlesex, and you mentioned beforehand about almost falling out of love with the game. So I just wanted to ask you, what would you say was your toughest moment at Middlesex during your 15-year career?
It's a good question. Probably just hiding how I was feeling from my friends and teammates and support staff, all of which I loved and respected, but hiding it from them because, you know, times have moved on. It's different times back then. I didn't know it was a mental health issue. Obviously, nowadays, you know, it's the likes of your Triscothic Trots, Freddies and stuff, everyone that's come out. I went to the doctors and I just thought the doctor told me just to drink more water, and I was probably dehydrated. And I was doing that, and I was playing with these panic attacks that I just didn't know what was happening, and they were out of body experiences, and it was really tough to play cricket with panic attacks, is the truth. And, you know, looking back on it, I needed medication and I needed help, but I was just fighting a bit of a lie and getting on with it. And I feel that, you know, it's just a bit, I'm a bit gutted that I lied to my mates, I lied to my teammates, lied to all the people that that sort of cared for me. And I didn't speak up, and, you know, I feigned injury to not play in matches, et cetera, et cetera. Just things that I really wasn't proud of. And halfway through games, I couldn't go on. So I just feigned injury and made out I pulled hamstrings and stuff like that. And Strousey or Joycey would have to keep. And looking back on it, it was pretty awful. I should have just owned up, and I'm sure it would have been dealt with. But no, I'm probably just a bit embarrassed still. That I didn't.
Well, to be honest, David, there's no need to be embarrassed about that, because as you said, nowadays, fortunately and thankfully as well, we are seeing more people speak out, and it's so important. It really is. I mean, I'm going to be honest, I haven't suffered anything to that extent. But I mentioned this before on the podcast, 2019 was not a great year for me personally, and I bottled stuff up as well. And then it's all about just having someone that you can almost confide in, someone who you trust, get it all out there. And yeah, afterwards, I felt a lot better ever since then. I'm lucky not to struggle with anything long term, but I do know people who do. And of course, it is definitely, well, it's massively important to get help. And as I said, to talk and get it off your chest. And you mentioned there about feigning injury. I found that really interesting. I read that on, I believe it's part of an extract from your book, which we'll talk about in due course. But just wanted to know, with regards to fear of failure, which is something that's cropped up a lot in terms of the book itself, I think on The Cricketer as well. You mentioned it in an interview with The Cricketer. What do you think it was about fear of failure? Was it the fear of letting yourself down, letting the team down, letting, I don't know, close friends and family down?
It wasn't about being embarrassed for letting myself down. It was being embarrassed just letting my teammates down and my parents and stuff like that, and everyone that was close to me, my brother, you know. And yeah, it was just that. And it's really, really, when you get in those dark places, it's very hard to get out of them. And you know, for the last 5 years, I literally was at my happiest when it was raining. When I opened my curtains and it was raining, I just couldn't be any happier, because it meant that I didn't have to put myself through the, you know, the fear of failure. But no, it was a really, really tough time. And, you know, I've learned a lot from it. And, you know, I would probably definitely, if I had my time again, deal with things differently. But it is what it is, you know. It's done now, and we move on. But definitely, look, there was probably a number of reasons as well. Look, if I'm totally honest, there was some management in Middlesex that probably didn't deal with me or others in the right manner. It was a very, very old school environment, very, very old school changing room. And yeah, there was probably a couple of the management team that contributed to my issues.
Well, to be honest, hearing that is, well, I mean, it's shocking, really, I suppose, because, I mean, we haven't really met each other before, David. Of course, we've only really spoken today. But, I mean, you come across as someone very chirpy, very chatty, very happy. And, of course, to hear that is, well, as I said, it's quite shocking, really.
But that's the thing. It took all my energy. I was still that person. I was the cheeky, chappy, the happy-go-lucky. No one would have known it because I had to mask it. And that took a lot of my energy. So, you know, the one thing that I would say is, look, just see how your mates are, because it's sometimes the ones that seem the happiest and the chirpiest that are struggling. So, you know, just some arm round and some straight conversations is really, really important, because sometimes people just find it difficult to talk about it, and you do never know. So as a mate, you've just got to, if you do feel that something's not quite right, you've really got to, drill down. You really have got to drill down it.
100%. And of course, that is fantastic advice for anyone out there, really, cricketer or non-cricketer, really listening to this podcast. And David, just along those same lines then, what advice would you have to maybe aspiring cricketers who are struggling with that fear of failure, maybe the expectations getting them down, for example? What do you say, or what advice would you give to those cricketers about how to deal with those issues?
It's your mates. Just speak openly to your mates, because a lot of cricketers get it. I've been, you know, it's really interesting to speak to sort of Straussie and stuff like that. And if people find ways of dealing with it, the best people find ways of dealing with, you know, Freddie obviously had his issues through certain things, and he hit the booze. I hit the booze as well, which basically magnified it, made it worse. So you think the booze is helping you and it's relaxing you, but actually over time it's making it a lot worse. So yeah, nowadays you've got all the people in place, and the clubs have got the people in place to basically help these cricketers. And you know, that's not beat around the bush, let's be straight. As I would say, and I know that there is a lot of cricketers and very young cricketers that are on medication, and whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, you know, it helps them through. But there's a lot of players, you know, that are using meds to get them through.
Well, it's a sad reality, that, isn't it, really? Because when you think, at the end of the day, cricket is just a game. But I suppose nowadays in particular, I think social media, and I wanted to ask your opinions on social media, actually, David, because obviously in your career, social media, it wasn't this massive phenomenon. It was very much a brand new thing. I think Twitter was in the late 2000s, same with Facebook and, of course, Snapchat and all that lot. What role do you think social media has played in exacerbating almost the pressures of cricket, both at the county level and the international level as well?
Oh, it's got to be huge, isn't it? Let's be honest. I mean, it's just in huge in modern day life. I don't do any social media whatsoever, or Instagrams and all that sort of stuff, and Twitter, I don't do it. But I've got five daughters, you know, they all do it, and you just see and hear the way that, you know, it affects a lot of these young girls as well. It's going to affect people, you know. People get affected by what people say. Doesn't matter who you are, it still affects you. All these England boys that read the press, and when the press say some negative stuff about them, it affects them 100%. Of course it does. They'll make out that they don't read the press or it doesn't affect them. Of course it does. Of course they hear it and they take it in. But just some are able to deal with it better than others. And, you know, and I just think that's sometimes in your makeup, or, you know, these days that you've got so many people around you, like psychologists and great people that are well-trained and you know how to deliver positive thoughts into you and the right, you know, the right answers to the questions that are great. And but in my time, it just wasn't really there for you. And when it was there, if you used it, you were looked at as probably a bit of a weirdo and someone that was weak.
Well, yeah, of course. And as we mentioned in this modern world now, it is a lot less stigmatized, isn't it, with regards to mental health? It's something which we've kind of recognized now is a genuinely serious issue. It's not just, as you said, something to be mocked or looked down at. It's something that should be taken extremely seriously. And with regards to what you said there about the England boys and the press, something that I learned, okay, I know a friend called Phil, well, he's not called Phil, I'm sorry, he's called Max Stokes, brilliant football YouTuber. And over the time of his vlogging and his YouTube channel, he's received so many terrible comments from people, from rival fans, and of course, sometimes from the Villa fan base themselves, if he says something controversial. We had a lengthy discussion about comments and negative comments, and we just spoke about, why is it always the negative comments that draw our attention? It's almost human nature, isn't it? We always draw our attention to those comments, even when you've got potentially hundreds, if not thousands of people who are there supporting you, not necessarily in comments, but in terms of liking your content, talking about your content. And yet everyone is bogged down by those negatives. And what I just wanted to ask, well, not ask, or what I wanted to say for any aspiring cricketers, any aspiring content creators out there as well, or podcasters, is you almost have to train yourself to let that go, filter those out, and focus not 100% on the positive comments. Sometimes criticism is, of course, an immensely valuable thing. But something that you have to remember, and it's something that I really took on board from that conversation with Max, was that you don't do it for those people. And it'd be the exact same for cricketers. You don't do it for the people on social media, the keyboard warriors, the trolls, whatever. You do it for the fans. You do it for the people who are close to you. You do it for the people who have supported you up until that point in your journey. And I think that's just a fantastic piece of advice. Of course, if either of you want to build upon that or elaborate, please feel free to do so. But I thought just that conversation with a very, very good mate of mine for a past couple of years now, that was very, very eye-opening to me personally.
And it's so sad to hear it. Let's be honest, all these keyboard warriors and these people, they're the mentally weak ones. They're the ones that just, you know, it's despicable, you know. And the way I sort of like and everything, if their parents saw what they were doing, you know, that they wouldn't exactly be very proud of them, would they? you know, it would it's just despicable, and they just get off by making people feel shit about themselves, and I just don't get it. I honestly don't get it, and I've seen people do it, and you know I used to go up my local pub on a Friday night or something, and you know, if we had a game off or something, and you know, the odd person would delight in coming over and going, "Oh, I've got you in my fantasy league team, and you've got me minus points or whatever." And I'd be like, you know, if I knew that they were having a bad time in their job, I wouldn't rub it in their face. I'd actually sort of go, "Oh, is everything all right? Do you need any help?" And it's just really, really, really sad that you get those people. You get those people in cricket. You know, you get the ones that are the selfish players that actually want other people to fail. You know, they want their competition to fail, or, you know, I can honestly say that all my competition, that the likes of Keith Brown, Ben Scott, David Elaine, John Simpson at Middlesex, never once did I want them to fail. I wanted them to do the best that they could do. And, you know, because at the end of the day, all I wanted to do was do the best that I could do. And if that wasn't good enough, then fair play. But there are these people that something in them dies sometimes if other people do well. And, it's the one thing that I would say to kids and people, young lads going into the change room, is don't just enjoy your own success. Really, really try hard to enjoy everyone else's success around you.
That is a fantastic piece of advice. And yeah, that's something that I live by, of course, not in a cricket dressing room. But yeah, in terms of looking at maybe budding content creators coming up, and of course, cricketers as well, as a massive Warwickshire fan, looking at the likes of Dan Mosley, for example, George Garrett, Rob Yates, it is special. And of course, I agree, it's something that I think we need to do more nowadays, is celebrate other successes, because it's all well and good being the king at the time, but then every dog has its day, don't they?
No, exactly. And Aaron, you have your day. You say about those floaty off spinners, you know, tell me your most successful day, the day that you came off the field and you loved it the most and you felt so proud that, Christ, that went well and I can have a beer with the boys and feel proud that I've done my bit.
Wouldn't have been with beers. It would have been in school cricket, so definitely no alcohol involved. But I think that would have been about year seven, year eight. And this wasn't when I was bowling off spin. This is when I tried to be the next Jimmy Anderson. And yeah, that didn't work. But what I did instead, went in school, rain affected. I think it ended up being an indoor match, actually. We started off outside and then moved the entire game indoor to our sports hall.
Brilliant.
And I took three wickets. And one of them in particular, I have a good friend of mine who I went sixth form with as well, known him for so many years now. And there was a ball that bowled good length. Okay, not the worst delivery ever. It wasn't like a pie. Batsman put it up in the air, went really high, almost touched the ceiling. As it dropped down, ran, full stretch dive, caught it one hand, right-handed. Still brag about it to my mate to this day.
Unbelievable. So, there you go.
Highlight of the career, almost like a Ben Stokes or a Joe, I know you're like this, a Glenn Maxwell diving catch per se, off my own bowling as well, CMB on the old scorecard. But yeah, I mean, that was many, many years ago. But yeah, I see what you mean now, David. Yeah, I mean, I still remember that to this day. That was in year seven.
Mate, yeah. Absolutely brilliant. Well done, mate. And I'm sure you got plenty more of them to come.
Well, hopefully with off-spin. I don't think I'll be venturing back into sea many times soon, I'm going to be honest. not with my bowling technique. But David, of course, just to kind of wrap up about your Middlesex career then, how would you describe your final season at Lords? Were you satisfied with the way in which it ended? Were you happy? Because we spoke with Jim Troughton on the last podcast about knowing the right time to retire. Did you feel like in 2009 that your body had had enough or your mind had had enough? Were you happy at that moment to say, you know what, enough's enough, I'm going to end my career now?
I think I'd have been happy for the last 5 or 6 years previous to that, to be totally honest with you. But I just didn't want to let, as I said, those sort of close to me down. And I didn't know what I was going to do next is the truth. And that fear of the unknown was something that stopped me from doing it. So it was something that kept me just saying, Christ, I've just got to carry on here. I've got young kids, I've got a wife, and I've got to provide. So that was the truth in the matter. But I remember playing in a charity game. I played that season. I was playing, I was getting some runs. It was all going all right. And I played in a charity game and I just really hated it. With chatted to Sean Udow and just said, look, I'm really, really not enjoying it. This is just too much. And he just said, what do you think? I said, look, I think I'm done. And he said, just like sit on it for 48 hours and then give me a shout. So he was the captain at the time. And I called him and just said, no, it's definitely the right thing to do. I remember going home, having a cry with the missus, and just saying, look, I'm absolutely done here. This is the time. And she was brilliant, really supportive. She just says, look, crack on. You do what you've got to do. We'll all be fine, and you'll make something work in life. So, and that was what happened. And I rang the CEO, who was absolutely brilliant, Vinnie Codrington. And the club couldn't have been more supportive, and the chairman couldn't have been more supportive. I think it was in June time, and they just said, look, Nashi, you've obviously been in the club as a cult since the age of 9 for 22 years or whatever. You're Middlesex through and through. You love the club. You bleed the club. You go above and beyond for the club. So don't play any cricket. Just come in, do a bit of 12th man, be around the boys in the change room, and just be a nice presence around the lads till the end of the season, which was great. I loved it.
You say that was a nice, that's how you pictured it.
I wouldn't say how I wanted it to end. It was just nice not having any pressure on me, knowing it was all over, and just being around my mates, trying to make them feel good, bringing the drinks on, running the jumpers on, just doing what I could to sort of help the lads out, being around my mates for the last few months before I had to sort of, you get a bit more lonely and isolated and you have to get out in the real world.
Well, you know what, David? It is nice to hear that the club was so supportive, though. And of course, you're an immensely popular character, not only in the club itself, but also with fans. I mean, the Middlesex faithful absolutely loved you. They love the character of David Nash, Nashy behind the stumps. What would you say to those Middlesex fans nowadays who are tuning in to today's podcast? Do you have any kind of messages just for those who really stood by you during those times?
The Middlesex fans were absolutely brilliant, because I used to love going on all the, on the away trips, we'd go on all the supporter groups, and you'd have Barmy Kev saying, Nashy's the best keeper, he gets runs. And you'd have Janet saying, nah, Scotty's the best keeper standing up. We've got to play a keeper stand up. Me and Scotty, we used to sort of read it all and joke with each other. And it was absolutely brilliant. Clubs, that is what clubs are about. People that have opinions. And do you know what? Every one of those people used to back us, though. You know, when the kids were young and had birthdays, they'd come in with, knit your jumpers for the kids. These people were the heart and soul of the club, and they were unbelievable. One thing Middlesex County Cricket Club is, it looks after its people, it looks after its players, and it is a class club, because what it does do, it builds young men that play the game in the right spirit, and more importantly, treat people in the right way. And you don't play for Middlesex without actually having total respect for not only your peers and the people you play with, but also the supporters and the people that give back to you in the club. And I would go above and beyond. If a supporter would ask me to do anything, I'd always do it. If they asked me to speak at a club dinner and give out trophies, I'd always do it. If someone needed a bat for their nephew, I'd go and get them a bat. That, that would be what I would do. And that's how I live my life. I want people to be happy. I want people to be happy in my company and smiling. And you know what? If you can't give back in this life, what have you got? And you know what? If you do give back, my big thing is that you'll end up reaping the rewards, because generally the big fella upstairs will look after you.
Well, David, that is absolutely wonderful hearing that. I think that is a fantastic summary. And you've just brought a smile to my face. I'm not a Middlesex fan per se. I mean, obviously got nothing against the London club as a Warwickshire fan. But yeah, just think, to Middlesex fans hearing that, I think that'd be absolutely brilliant. And of course, I mean, on their behalf, I mean, I'll just say it, thank you for the service at the club. I mean, as we said, 15 years, very, very good keeper, very funny personality as well. And I think I'm not alone in saying that you were definitely missed down at Lord's. But Nashi, let's just talk away from cricket then, because you mentioned there about giving back. And this is something which I found so inspirational when doing my pre-podcast research, and that is D&G Group. Do you just want to quickly touch upon what you guys actually do? Because just looking at the figures here, 20 million plus pounds raised for charity for 450 plus charities. I mean, that is absolutely incredible.
So I was very, very lucky in the fact that the club gave me a testimonial year for my time at the club. And because I'd basically done people a lot of favours over the years, coached their kids, and always tried to basically, whatever people would ask me to do, I would always do it, because do you know what? I wanted to make people happy. I was a bit of a pleaser. So when it came to me having a testimonial year and creating a committee and asking everyone that basically that I'd helped over the years for their support in taking tables to events, supplying auction items, etc., the response was overwhelming, and I broke the benefit record at Middlesex. I broke the record. And in that year, I was able to give quite a lot of money. over £30,000 to Shooting Star Chase Children's Hospice, which is a local hospice close to me, where I live in Sunbury in Hampton. And I went down with my benefit chairman, Andy Bowden, close mate of mine, to see it and, you know, to see what all these families go through. And when you come home and you see the missus and the kids, you know, you can have a great life, all can be going swimmingly, and then you can get one bit of shocking news that basically turns your life upside down. And that's what was happening to these families. So Shooting Star Chase supports 650 families across the Surrey area in bereavement, and houses them when their children have life-limiting illnesses, which is absolutely shocking, but it provides them with the care that they need and those, you know, the final stages of their lives. So look, able to support them was amazing. I still, you know, to this day, we run a dinner every year for them, which is absolutely incredible. And I get 600 of my mates to attend, and we raise a lot of money for them, which is great because, you know, we're lucky and fortunate that we can give back in that way. And yeah, we set up a business. So I wanted to give back. I wanted to make a difference, but I obviously wanted it to also not be, I had to support my family, and I went into business with my brother, and we had an idea. We took it to John King, the CEO of House of Fraser. I remember I used to basically take tickets at events where CEOs would be at. And I went and looked at the table plan, and I saw the CEOs that I wanted to go into. I went into about 7 CEOs that night. One of them was John King at House of Fraser. I Googled what he looked like. I went up to him whilst he was eating his lamb shank, and I tapped him on the shoulder and said, "John, I'm David Nash. I'm a shit ex-cricketer at Middlesex. I feel like I've got something for you that could be great for your foundation and your CSR and your charitable causes. Someone gave you your opportunity, John. I hope you can please give me mine." And he looked at me and said, "I quite like you." I said, "Oh, thank you." And he said, "I'll see you Tuesday, 9 o'clock. Gave me his card, and I went and meet him Tuesday, 9 o'clock at House of Fraser head office at Baker Street. And he said, "I love the model, love the concept, love what you guys want to do. You've got your opportunity." And I remember ringing my brother on the way home saying, "Now we've got to make it happen." And we did.
The rest is history, as I say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. What a story. And as I said beforehand, yeah, what an amazing, well, group, I suppose. It really is. £20 million over the course of 10 years for brilliant, brilliant charities as well. As you mentioned there, with a hospice. I mean, it must be absolutely horrific to go through that as a family, of course. But then if you can help in any way that you can, and obviously the group have done that. I know I keep on mentioning this word today, David, but inspirational. And to be honest,
yeah, we're blessed. We get to wake up in the morning and make a difference, mm-hmm. which gives you the energy to get out of bed. And we're very, very blessed. I've been blessed throughout my life being a professional cricketer. And now I'm blessed in my business life going out there to make a difference. And if we can make a difference, however small it may be, we can all do more. I can do more marathons. I can run more Tough Mudders. I can do more bike races through the Alps or whatever. We can all do more. And I think just sometimes we just get a little bit lazy and a little bit bogged down in our own existence and forget what's actually important. And I think for mental health, it's really important for me to do at least a few of those things every year, because it helps me, drive me on, and makes me feel better about myself as well day to day.
Absolutely. And I mean, for me personally, I know Joe, you'll obviously agree with me on this one, but I absolutely love that attitude. Of course, it's brilliant, David. It really is. And it's admirable, to say the least. It's just inspired me to think maybe I could do more as well. So David, of course,
I mean, you should do a podcast from every single ground next year, or you should make sure you do it from every single ground, and you do something from every single ground, or you come up with something that basically is a bit different and a bit entrepreneurial, and raise some money, well, you know, for a good cause, and stick me in for a couple of hundred quid for your starting donation.
That would be incredible, David. And you know what? We'll try and come up with something. We'll get the County Cricket Podcast think tank on that, because that'd be absolutely incredible to obviously give back in any way that we can. But away from business, David, of course, you're now also turned into an author. And let's talk just quickly about your book, Bells and Boardrooms, which is going to be released on the 22nd of March. And I just looked at this book and I thought, my goodness, this is going to be interesting. It's going to be very thought-provoking. And I just wanted to ask you, obviously, as the author, you've produced this brilliant book. What do you think that we as the readers could expect from the book itself? What could we expect to see in Bells and Boardrooms?
You're just going to get total honesty from me. You're just going to get the truth. You're going to get the warts and all of my life in cricket, and then how I applied it and how I've managed to apply it to business. You're going to get the people that were good, the people that were bad, the people that were nice people, the people that weren't. You're just going to get total honesty from me in it. And more importantly, you're going to get basically the reason I really wanted to do it was because I wanted to actually show those cricketers that finished, because I don't know if you know, but there's a very high suicide rate in cricket. And when you finish the game, you do feel very low. I get very, very depressed because you're there with your mates, you're having fun, you're around people, and then suddenly it's gone. You've been a someone, and then suddenly that you've got nothing. You've got no CV. No one wants to employ you, and a lot of players get low. So basically, it was just showing all those people that, you know, a short, fat, bald bloke from Sunbury with pretty much no skills, no education, really, not many A levels or GCSEs. If you're willing to graft hard, join the dots up, network well, and be a good bloke, you can make it happen.
Exactly. Some very, very sound advice. And David, there was just a piece on your social media, or that your social media team put out, and it's absolutely brilliant. It's a quote from yourself, and it's with regards to the book. One of the most important things was to put the issue of mental well-being in sport front and centre stage. We can all do more to look after each other, and I hope my new book helps others who might be suffering. It's hard to write about your own struggles, but it's been hugely rewarding too. I just read that and I thought, my goodness, this guy is just so open and honest. And it's something which is very, very refreshing, of course, because in the modern era, I mean, don't get me wrong, some people are very, very honest and open. But just hearing that as well, it's not just about yourself.
Yeah, you know, I suppose it is in a way. Let's be totally honest. Mental health is your mental wealth, isn't it? Let's be honest.
True.
There's no getting away from it. And if you're in a good place mentally, then life is rosy, and not everyone is. And, you know, you need your mates around you to pick you up when you're not. So I just think it's really, really important. It's okay now to not be okay, but I think it's just really important for your sort of your mates and the people close to you to just always, you know, just ask each other, you know, they might from the outside seem happy, but just if you're detecting anything, then just make sure you jump in and do what you can do.
Yeah, and it is an excellent point. And as we keep on mentioning throughout today's podcast, we keep on hammering home this point. It's so important to talk. And I know that sounds so cliche, but it is so important. And it's so simple, but it's so true. And definitely something to take away from this podcast. But David, away from the book, of course, and away from the business, what does the future hold for David Nash? What have you got planned in store for the next, I don't know, 3-4 years, for example?
Firstly, before I answer that question, I just want to say, actually, I actually watched The Edge on the way out to Barbados on the plane.
Documentary.
It was on the plane, and I thought it was absolutely brilliant. I think your likes of your Trott, your Finn, Steve Finn, all those sort of guys that were in it, I thought it was absolutely brilliant. So I just want to say just hats off to the guys, Strousey, etc., that were involved with that. I thought it was absolutely brilliant, gripping viewing. But no, so for me, what is the next stage of my future? Well, it's basically just I want to keep making a difference in life, not just necessarily on the charity side, but just actually partnering with my friends in business opportunities, because what I enjoy the most is actually, you know, when you win, it's better to win with your mates. So I've had some ideas out here. We're looking to set up I'm here currently for the next few months, looking to set up a Schools Cricket World Cup in Antigua and Barbados in August 2022, which will be backed by Sir Andrew Strauss and Sir Vivian Richards. The West Indies Cricket Board have given their backing, as have the Tourist Board and the government. So that's great. Something that we're pushing forward. And basically what we want to do is we want to create also, obviously there'll be a lot of independent schools involved, but from the giving back side, we want to basically create 16 players from inner city areas and the state school environment that haven't had it necessarily easy, and create almost like a school of hard knocks. So Strousey and the guys, Ram Prakash and all my sort of pals will coach them up and help them with online leadership platforms, et cetera, et cetera. And learning to then take on the might of these big schools, and hopefully that they'll do us state school boys proud.
Love it, Nashie. And of course, from us too here at the County Cricket Podcast, we just want to wish you a massive, massive deal of luck, really, because it sounds like a wonderful initiative. I mean, we wish you the very best of luck for the future as well. Not only with the book, of course, we hope for a successful launch with that, but of course with the charity stuff as well, because it really is fantastic. It's a fantastic thing to do, and you should be immensely proud of that, David. And of course, we wish you the very best of luck in all facets heading into the next 3-4 years of your life and beyond that.
Thanks, guys. I love what you're doing. And if I can be of any help for anything that you guys do going forward, then please give me a shout. But love what you're doing. And let's keep our great game going, because let's be honest, there's no better game.
Absolutely. Fantastic way to put it. And David, just to end today's podcast then, we do just have 10 quickfire questions to round off today's podcast about the wonderful game of cricket. So first of all then, David, our first question for you, Test or ODI, which do you prefer?
Test.
Good answer.
Good answer. The right answer as well. The next one, Root or Morgan?
Morgan.
Fair play.
A pretty he's obvious a answer as well. Yeah, pretty obvious
he's
answer.
He's one of my pals. I couldn't say it. Couldn't say Rooty. I don't know Joe Root, but what a player.
I think we knew that was coming, to be honest. Next one then, David. Viv Richards or Brian Lara?
Jesus. Got to go BC there, because I didn't see enough of Viv. I'd have to go BC. What a player.
Fair play.
Fair enough. The next one, cover drive or reverse sweep?
Oh, reverse sweep. I never hit a cover drive in my life. The only time I hit a ball through the covers was when it was a leading edge.
Fair enough. Did you have much success off the reverse sweep?
I wouldn't say masses, but definitely more than the cover drive.
Well, fair enough.
You can tell your keeper, David. Always love their sweeps for the keepers.
Exactly.
100%. Next question then. T20 orientated this one. Indian Premier League or T20 Blast?
Can't beat the IPL, can you? It's just unbelievable. It's a different level. Got to go IPL. I just think we need more razzmatazz. We just need a bit more fun in ours. I think it's good, but I definitely think there's room for improvement. IPL is just on another level.
Yes, it is. It is an exceptional competition. Mm-hmm. The next one. Would you rather win a Lords final without scoring a run or lose a Lords final but score 100?
Obviously, win a Lords final without scoring a run.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we
there's a few that wouldn't, though.
Well, of course, but yeah, I think we knew that was coming, David, after this today's podcast. Next one, this is going to be a difficult one. Jimmy Anderson or Stuart Broad?
Oof, Jimmy Anderson.
Well, Joe, you'll like that one. Yeah.
Jimmy Anderson.
It's got to be Jimmy.
Yeah, it's got to be Jimmy.
I mean, it's one of them questions, isn't it, where they're both virtually geniuses. Inseparable. Yeah, it's one of them questions.
Both have had their hair done, so if one of them had their hair done and they were more vain than the other, I would have probably said the other one, but they're both obviously quite vain. But they both seem great blokes, to be honest with you, from when I've met them, but I'm probably just going to go Jimmy Anderson.
Fair enough.
The next one, Gray Nichols or Kookaburra?
Got to go Gray Nichols, because my good mate Nick Wilton has worked there for many years, and it's an English brand rather than an Aussie brand. I can't. It's like Marmite or Vegemite or whatever. You'd never have veggie over Marmite, would you? So you can't have Kookaburra over Grey Nicks.
Good answer there, David. So moving on to our penultimate one then. This is an interesting one. Shoaib Akhtar or Brett Lee, who would you rather not face?
Well, I remember facing Shoaib Akhtar, and I have never shit my pants so much. He bowling down the hill at the Riverside with a gale force wind behind him, reduced to a 30-over game at the end of the season. He was playing for his contract. Honestly, I've never seen anything like it. He knocked Strousey and Shah's stumps all over the place. I've never been so scared for my life. It was brutal. Never faced Brett Lee, but that day against Shoaib Akhtar, I just realised, Jesus Christ, this international cricket wasn't quite for me.
Well, as I say, two legendary bowlers, they bowl rockets, don't they? But yeah. I mean, sure. I mean, either one would not be nice to face. But yeah, fair enough. And then the final one, would you rather bat in India or Australia?
India. I love facing spin. Definitely India, more fun. People round the bat. You can have a bit of banter when you're batting with the keepers, the slips, the men round the bat. Definitely India all day long. And it'd mean more. Getting 100 at day four, day five in Chennai or somewhere like that would be probably, obviously it wouldn't be the Ashes, but for me it would be getting runs in India.
Fair enough. Of course, yeah, you could get the sweep out as well on the low returning wickets.
Exactly.
It makes sense, David. But that does bring us to an end to today's This or That segment. And of course, it brings us to an end to a fantastic podcast. So, David, just before we do end today's podcast, do you have anything just final to plug or promote just before we leave?
No, just thanks for your support, guys. Look, I hope you read the book, guys. We're supporting the Ruth Strauss Foundation through all the sale of the book. Strauss is obviously a close mate of mine. Ruth was also a very close mate of myself and my wife, Jules. And you don't get better people. You've got a brilliant charity there. Do what you can. Get online and support the Ruth Strauss Foundation. And keep enjoying yourself. Keep loving our great game. And just, you know, also just look out for all your close mates, because they might look on the outside. It might be slightly different on the inside.
100%, David. Fantastic words to end on, and words that we here at the County Cricket Podcast definitely echo. But that does bring us to an end to a fantastic podcast. David, thank you so much for joining us here on the County Cricket Podcast today. It's been absolutely brilliant. To all of the listeners out there, thank you very much for tuning in. And as always, guys, we'll see you on the next one.